Thank you all. I'm Kathy Kattari, and I'm here to tell you about a study that we conducted, it's a local study that we conducted in Kalamazoo, Michigan. This study was the result of a partnership between myself at the medical school, Garland, who's one of the medical students, and the community mental health agency in our community in Kalamazoo. The impetus for this particular, this was secondary analysis of a study we had conducted looking at crime victimization and criminal involvement among community mental health consumers at large, and we found a really strong correlation between that and really strong health utilization that was attributed and associated with crime victimization and being a defendant or a perpetrator in a crime. So we wanted to look and zero in much very specifically and look at the differences across different types of categories of consumers who with different disabilities, and in this case, looking very specifically at the consumers with developmental intellectual disabilities in this. I have no conflicts to disclose. Just to sort of provide a broad framework, we know that there is, you know, from self-report data, we know that there's a very high correlation of disability, both mental and physical disability, with crime victimization, and that a lot of it, whether it's self-report or based on crime data, is quite a bit higher than it is among general population. We know, similar to the general population, that about half of crime victims do not report the crime itself to authorities. Few of them report, and they cite a lot of the same reasons, although these reasons are much more marked among individuals with disabilities. So like anybody else, you know, the primary reasons is fear of retaliation, fear of shame and stigma, but also really just not knowing who to report to or how to go about reporting. Sometimes when, especially with regards to the, you know, depending on the type of crime, they may not have considered that a crime was committed, that they were the victims of a crime. So there's a lot that gets in the way in general, and all of the same things that get in the way more for individuals with disabilities. As a result, not only do they not report to the authorities, but they often don't disclose to professionals, to healthcare professionals who are working with them, especially providers, mental health providers who are working with them. It may not be anything that comes out, and if it's not explicitly asked, a lot of times it's not explicitly disclosed. And that means that a lot of folks who could use therapy or could use some assistance working through some of the trauma that's associated with victimization just don't get help. Those that do disclose and that do receive some sort of therapy overwhelmingly report that this does provide some benefit to them. And so we really wanted to look at that. In our community, like I say, we had a very strong, one of the reasons for looking at the original study is that our community mental health has a very strong relationship with the criminal justice system. So we have on the perpetrator side. So in the jail, we have a community mental health has screeners in the jail that do a lot of screening of folks who are in the jail. We also have a mental health recovery court and a substance abuse court, drug court as well. So it's a population that we're really poised to do a lot with. Our particular study goals for this analysis was wanted to identify the criminal involvement, both victimization and perpetration, using administrative records for our population here in Kalamazoo. And we wanted to look at the health utilization that was associated with that, both to look at sort of a proxy for the impact on health, but also as another opportunity, another setting within which you can identify and address and link people to care. Our study methods, we looked at a cross-sectional study, a period of risk among the entire population of community mental health consumers in the year 2009. We built an integrated database from that. I'm going to talk about how we built that in a minute, because we used a variety of different linkage methods to do that building. And we linked data across community mental health. We used administrative records in all three systems, the three systems being community mental health, the criminal justice system, and the hospital systems in my community. The sample itself was, like I said, it was a census sampling, so it was the entire population of anybody who had received a service from community mental health in the year 2009. We moved away from the diagnosis coding for categorizing what kind, you know, and what sort of service and what sort of population within the consumer population. We really went with our definition. We used the services received. So the we categorized the type of service received. So someone who had received, you know, a service that was a mental health service fell into the mental health category. We compared, when we looked at, there was at the same time, there was a statewide study that looked at, that used diagnosis code. And when we compared our mental health individuals with disability, the cognitive and cognitive or developmental disability, we had the same prevalence as the statewide study. So it really validated that services received were really closely aligned with diagnosis. We weren't losing much. And it, the services received felt more, was something that we went with our local folks who said this is really what matters, that the diagnosis codes really don't, they don't capture necessarily the sorts of problems and the sorts of services, especially when we start looking at acuity. Let me talk a little bit about our database and what we built. So we started, as I said, with community, with our sample, which is drawn from the Community Mental Health Agency. In addition to the kind of services that they receive, which we used to categorize them into service types, we also looked at demographics. We pulled in the demographics that were age, kind of the traditional age, race, gender. We had education and employment, and we're really interested, again, in looking at some of the disparities that might be associated with these demographic factors, particularly those associated with socioeconomic status or race. In addition to the people, we were interested in the services. We looked at services over a 7-year period, although for the purposes of this study, we just zeroed in on the services in 2009, and we pulled out, again, specific to this study, of all the services we looked at, we pulled out the psych hospitalization services because that was one of our outcome measures. How do we identify and how do we define criminal justice involvement? What we did is we went to our local prosecutor's office and we partnered with them. And we downloaded from their administrative records all of their charging requests. In Michigan and in Kalamazoo County, you've got all the folks who call into 911, where there's a police officer dispatched to the scene. Among the police, when you've been dispatched to the scene, there's a subset, about 50%, that lead to a police have determined that a crime, that the incident has risen to the level of a crime, and they submit a charging request to the prosecutor's office. The prosecutor's office then authorizes for prosecution some percent of those that they feel it could be adjudicated. And usually they authorize about 67-68% of those charging requests. Our data was all of the police identified charging requests. So that's what we went with. If the police thought that a crime had been committed, that was what we got pulled into our download. The information that was collected was over this decade from 2000 to 2010. We looked at all of the crime charging. We were able to pull in and look at both the role of the who is the victim, who is the defendant. We looked at the dates, and we pulled it into the charge. So we further categorized the charges into assault, malicious destruction of property or property-related crimes, and any crime that had a victim named on it. There's a lot of crimes that get committed that are retail crime where there isn't a person who's a victim. So we only looked at person victimization crimes. We linked, one note about being able to use, in our state, the prosecuting attorney office receives funding from VOCA, from the state level VOCA office. And so we had to go appeal to the state level VOCA office to get permission to get information, especially because we were looking at identified information about victims of crime. So we did receive that permission. We ended up, in terms of linking, because we didn't have a numeric link, what we had is we had names, date of birth in the charging request, and names and date of birth in the community mental health database. And so we use a linking program called Link Plus, and it's a linking program, it's a free linking matching program that's developed by the CDC, and it's a probabilistic linking that takes into account at Soundex, so it allows you to link alphanumeric data. So we were able to do through multiples, and I can talk in great detail, unfortunately, about that particular linking and all the different sweeps we went through, but we use that approach to link these two data sets. We also collected and pulled in information from the two operating hospitals in my county. They're both Trauma One centers. We looked at the emergency department visits as well as the hospitalizations, and we used a different linking process for here. For linking to the emergency department and the hospital visits, we took all of the people in our list and we did a manual search for their medical record numbers within each of the two hospital settings. And we compiled the list of all the MRNs and then submitted that request to each of the hospitals' health information management, and then they produced and exported all of the visits and the ICD-9 codes that were associated with this population. Obviously, this was an IRB-approved study. So just looking at the demographics first, so what we did is we zeroed in our comparison and we looked at, for the demographics, we compared the consumers who had a physical developmental disability with those who had a mental health disability. And they were really different, right? So the folks that had an intellectual or developmental disability tended to be older than their counterparts. They were more likely to be white and non-minority, and in fact, their racial distribution was much more similar to the county as a whole than consumers who are mental health or substance use consumers. They were less likely to be. They had lower levels of education and lower levels of employment, either supported employment or in the workforce in any capacity. But they were more likely to be married. So just looking at the consumer group and some of the differences among the consumers with developmental disabilities. What about the crime involvement? So we'll say that the crime involvement varied quite dramatically, as you can see, across consumer group, with the developmental disability consumers having the lowest level of crime involvement, in fact, lower than the general population in the community outside of consumers, whereas consumers with mental health disability or substance use had much, much higher criminal justice involvement. And here, this encompasses whether that involvement was as a victim or a perpetrator. When we piece it down and parse it into the was there criminal involvement as a victim or a perpetrator, we see that the developmental disability group is really different. They're much more likely than their counterparts to be victims rather than defendants in a crime. You can see that ratio, it really flips. So they're quite different, and this leads to some differences in their healthcare utilization as well. We further drilled down because we're working with the Kathy Lentz, who is the Division Director of Intellectual and Developmental Disability Services. She said, you know, it really matters whether there's a dual diagnosis, whether the individuals have a mental health co-occurring diagnosis as well. So we split that apart. Among our population, we said about a third of them had a mental health co-occurring diagnosis, and what we found is she was exactly right, because as far as the crime involvement go, when we split it apart and looked at the victimization and perpetration ratio, we found that those with a mental health diagnosis resembled those without a co-occurring, the rest of the mental health consumers. They were much more closely aligned with them, so they're much more likely to be perpetrators in a crime rather than victims in a crime, and that the remaining non-mental health diagnosed individuals with developmental or intellectual disabilities were much more likely to be victims. It increased their victimization rate by up to like 3.5. Okay, so really increased the degree to which they were victims, not perpetrators in crime. We also looked at, did any of the demographic characteristics predict victimization? And we found that absolutely none of them did. There were none of the factors, age, race, marital, educational, employment status, that predicted victimization among this population. And having a co-occurring mental health diagnosis also did not predict victimization. What it did predict is mental health co-occurring, as I just said, did predict the perpetration of crime. And in fact, individuals with developmental intellectual disabilities with a co-occurring mental health diagnosis had over 7 times greater likelihood of being a perpetrator in a crime than those who did not have this co-occurring disability. This fact did not vary by age, race, marital status, employment, or education at all. What about healthcare utilization? What we know from earlier studies is that community mental health consumers, in general, have about triple the rate of emergency department visits compared to the general population. What we found is that those who were crime involved, in general, among consumers, had another 3 times higher rate. When we broke it down by service type, what we find is that that's very specific to, this also varied very much by service type, so that when we looked at individuals with developmental disabilities, they had slightly less increase, but that increase was experienced whether you were a victim or a perpetrator in a crime. So compared to those with mental health disabilities, those with substance abuse, they had much higher emergency department rates that were associated with being crime involved than individuals with physical or intellectual disabilities. And the reasons for the emergency department visit did not vary based on crime involvement. It varied much more by service type and service category. And we see that among the individuals with physical or intellectual disabilities, they're much more likely to have emergency department visits that are injury related compared to other consumer groups. Across consumer groups, there is the predominant reason for an emergency department visit, though, is for a medical reason, just like the rest of the community, right? There's no differences there. We looked at psychiatric hospitalizations, and as you can see, we had really high rates of psychiatric hospitalizations among the consumer groups with mental health and substance abuse, as well as mental health. You can see it really sort of, you know, goes down, and that the individuals with intellectual or developmental disabilities had the lowest rates of psychiatric hospitalizations. And the exception to this, though, is that subset of individuals within the group that had a mental health co-occurring, and they were much more likely to be perpetrators in crime. So being a crime perpetrator and being a defendant in a crime was very much to do with having a mental health co-occurring diagnosis among this group. We saw that earlier, we see it again in a different way here. Finally, looking at the medical hospitalizations, we saw that no differences based on crime involvement to medical hospitalizations, that the vast majority of medical hospitalizations had to do, again, with medical reasons. The reason for visit among consumer groups compared to others had much more to do, though, with poisoning, substance use or addiction, or injury, just in general. That did not vary at all. The reason for medical hospitalization did not vary by crime involvement. And you can see here that even among when we look at just a subgroup of those with intellectual or developmental disabilities, there's no relationship between their medical hospitalization rate or reason and their victimization or perpetration in a crime. What did we learn? What are we doing with this? Just to summarize, crime involvement by consumers is relatively infrequent, less frequent than it is among the general population. When it occurs among the subgroup, it is much more likely to be crime victimization than it is to be crime perpetration, with the exception of the mental health co-occurring subgroup, which much more resembles the mental health consumers in general than the intellectually and developmentally disabled consumers without the co-occurring. What are we doing about this? Regardless of whether criminal involvement is a victim or a perpetrator, double the rates among the developmentally disabled group, double the rates of the emergency department visits across the board, but not medical hospitalizations. And psychiatric hospitalizations are increased, but again, they're increased for the subgroup of those with the mental health co-occurring. In our community, we've started to take some action around this. We're screening community mental health just started instituting a universal screen with their annual assessments for all populations, including this population. Even though their rates are so much lower, their rates of crime involvement are so much lower. So they're starting to screen regularly and assess for any sort of trauma involvement and crime involvement, both as a child as well as an adult, as well as ongoing criminal justice involvement and victimization. started to conduct a series of staff trainings around trauma-informed care and trauma-informed behaviors and how trauma affects behaviors within all populations, whether you are a consumer population or not. We are trying to, we haven't done as good of a job in this expanding the treatment and resource capacity around treating for trauma. That's something that we're working on, but that's a long time coming. Within the providers, the CMH providers, they're starting to screen, but they really don't have we don't have any place to refer folks, and we don't have a big PTSD or trauma-informed care that's specific to trauma. So that's something that we're developing and working on, but it is not in place at the moment. What we are trying to do is try to start having conversations with all our consumers, especially the ones in the intellectual and developmental disabilities, around crime prevention, safety behaviors, communication, conflict resolution, when to get out, what's a dangerous situation, and when to leave. And connecting them to our local resources, especially legal aid and the YWCA, which is our domestic violence shelter. I'm going to leave it there because I'm out of time and I don't want to enter into our discussion time. But I'm happy to field questions once we sit down. Thank you so much.
All right. Now it's your turn to pose questions to the panel. And I see we have one already. Well, three already. All right. Linda, you'll go first.
My question is for Tony Cahill. I noticed, especially being from Massachusetts, I noticed that Massachusetts had one of the highest rates of spinal cord injury, or paralysis, I should say, but yet it was on every other measure much more positive, which contrasted with the Southeast Central region. So I just wondered if you had any thoughts about why that might be.
No.
Hey Tony, why don't you join the panel here?
Sorry?
Why don't you join the panel here and then you can use the mic?
Oh, no. I'll just say that those of you.
Maybe not.
Well, this is way more trouble than it's worth. Those of you who engage in large scale data analysis know that the data are great at saying what, and the data are less great at saying why. So,
yeah.
I mean, no, I don't.
Hi, Stephanie Silvera from the University of Houston. My question was for the GLB team. So I worked with Baylor College of Medicine on a weight loss intervention based on the DCP for women with mobility impairments. And something that we've ran into a bit, especially for women in power wheelchairs, was thinking that 1,200 calories, which we know is, you know, what you need to meet most of your nutrient needs, was way too much. So it became this focus on exercise to increase energy expenditure to get them to feel comfortable with that. Are you experiencing that too with women and men in your sample?
Yeah, we're running into the very same question. And so it's going to be a really interesting thing, I think, to see what happened with these individuals over the course of the year and what kind of outcomes we have and where that takes us with people with a higher level injury. And Dr. Perlicker, we would like to add something.
We don't really know is what is the resting metabolic rate, but one can surmise, given higher injury levels, that it is lower than 1,200 calories. And so the problem is, I think that we run into is we are not medically staffed. And so if you're going to go below 1,000 calories, that's considered for a low calorie diet, and we can't advise that. But we actually ran into just this week, or last week, one of our participants, physicians, basically said, okay, I want you to try the lifestyle approach, and I'm going to put you on a very low-calorie diet, in which I will supervise. And we can't argue with that, if that's what he feels he needs to do, because she's had a very precipitous weight gain. So, you know, what we were doing is starting with asking the question, is this going to be appropriate? And I think we're going to find our answers to then guide us to the next stage for people who have higher levels of impairment. But at least in our pilot, you know, if people can exercise and get at least a portion of their body and trunk involved, I think that we were able to see the weight loss. And even with this current group, at only 11 weeks, we're seeing some weight loss. So for some people, it is sufficient. But the question is what to do for those who have really low resting metabolic rate.
So my question is again for you, Ms. Betts, I think. How long are you going to measure the effects past the end of the intervention? I ask because, you know, we have a lot of data from other health promotion interventions, Living Well and others, that the effects will start to wash out between 9 and 12 months. Are you going to try to do a longitudinal evaluation?
Right. Unfortunately, we're not funded to do that for this particular trial. We are measuring them at 12 months, so we'll have at least a year's worth of data. And so maintenance is absolutely an ongoing question that I think most of the weight loss community has sort of yet to solve. So we're starting where we can, but we would like to absolutely propel this into something where we can get a little bit longer follow-up.
By the way, very nice presentation, very nice study.
Thank
you. Hi, this is BJ from the University of Illinois, Chicago. I also have a question for the GLP team. I'm just curious what you guys are doing to make the intervention culturally appropriate, especially for the Latin and Hispanic groups as well.
That's a great question. We did not go through a cultural adaptation process with this advisory board. We were really focused specifically on making it appropriate for the mobility impaired community. So I think that would actually be a second round of adaptations. You know, one concern I have is around the Hispanic community and, you know, possibly bilingual. So that's something I think that's going to warrant further investigation. We're still in the very early stages of this.
But I do want to mention that the GLP has been successful across a variety of age groups and racial and ethnic communities, and so, but it has not been explicitly adapted for those. But there is having success in the main GLP.
I just wanted to mention. We're excited about this work too, and the work going on at Baylor and overall state, you know, just connecting these kind of group facilitated health education to other distance technologies like telemedicine and things that we're sharing second life. And it's really important for organizing paralysis populations who are spread across a large geographic region. So I hope that's part of some of the adaptations we'll be looking at as you guys move forward with your learning here. Really exciting. Catherine is aware we've been tracking the disability status of participants going through the program in Montana, and we are seeing equal participation rates, and people are doing the same self-monitoring, but we are not seeing the same percentage weight loss, 5% versus the 7% in disabled versus non-disabled populations participants. So that, I was chomping on a bit to see what you guys are learning through this research. I don't really have a question, though. I really have a question for Amber about just the poverty and the insurance, kind of those two variables I'm looking at that, and just thinking about how many families and individuals who have disability we'll talk about how they've impoverished themselves to obtain insurance, and if that's part of what you're trying to tease out by looking at those two. In some ways, we're talking about poverty as a protective factor, or disability as a protective factor in poverty, but really people actually move themselves into poverty to get insurance, or at least we hear that anecdotally.
I have heard that anecdotally as well, however, that's not something we're able to, that's not something we're really able to tease out in this type of analysis. I think that that's working out.
Okay.
I think where the discussion comes from, you know, disability being protective towards, you know, insurance status is sort of separate discussion.
I don't think about it. I mean, eligibility-wise, we look at the poverty line itself. So in some states, the eligibility is, I think, up to 300 times the poverty limit. So we were looking at a more extreme group. And if a family were to need to get down to a level just to meet eligibility, it would not be as far down as what we were looking at. So we did this as a broad cut just to look at those who are extremely impoverished and what happens with their insurance status.
Hi, I'm Catherine. This was a wonderful panel. Thank you so much for this wonderful research, and it's great to hear it presented. I've got actually two questions for two different groups. So for the first flower group, really intriguing data. I just have a question of whether we should use the term protective as disability as a protective factor, especially in light of the question that Meg just asked. Because it also is increasing the need for all those healthcare services, and you guys didn't look at quality. So just a question about that. And then my second question is for you. I've recently worked with colleagues at my school to analyze data from, and this is actually in press right now, from incarcerated populations where we are looking by disability status. And we see that on all the risk factors in terms of parent being in prison, having a personal experience of being in foster care, and being, they don't call it victimized, but having a history of abuse. Those who had all sorts of disabilities, not just intellectual disabilities, and not exclusively mental health, although, you know, the questions that were asked on the survey by the prisoners, I'm not sure what it was off the top of my head, but they all had higher rates of those things. And so I know, I love the fact that you had actually objective data from both the hospitals as well as the crime report, but is it possible that there is an early childhood history for some of these people that is predisposing them to become perpetrators?
I think that's a great question, and we don't. That obviously it wasn't in the data, but what we know is that criminal justice perpetration has more to do with your social environment than your that the things that are associated with crime and criminal incidents are your peer and your social environment, no matter your health status, like no matter your mental health or physical health status. And so I would say that very much that would continue to sort of be the highest rate and the highest thing that sort of drove crime perpetration is antisocial peers, antisocial environment. That's often, you see that often in lower income, higher crime neighborhoods, because that sort of, and it, so it's part of childhood, and childhood trauma is very much associated with victimization, and it's also associated with perpetration, but it's not what drives perpetration that other research has identified. It's more the antisocial versus pro-social peers and environment.
Emily or Eric, I don't know, did you want to respond to the initial question?
Sure. I think the term protective comes from a bit that what we saw in participation of health insurance status was the overwhelming participation within public insurance. And that is really a safety net program, and that their participation in that is likely due to their eligibility due to their disability. So the reason that we view protective against community health insurance is they're able to participate in those protective programs due to the nature of their disability. We could use other terms, but that's really where that's coming from.
Hi, this is Monica Mitchell. I'm at UMass Medical School, and I had a great presentation. Thank you so much. I have a question for Dr. Pattari. I was really intrigued with the way you approached it, and your entire study, and the linkage. So I had a question. Did you look at a residential pipe for people with intellectual development?
We really wanted to. And we really worked with Kathy Lentz and a community mental health agency. So if we do anything that we can get at, as an institutionalized setting, what sort of family home setting, like anything.
Yeah.
And she, we really weren't able to, she really wasn't able to produce
use available that would have captured that, that we could really look at across the board. If that part of that discussion came out and what where that led us was to add in the mental health co-occurring piece, because she said, I don't think it, in her mind, she said it isn't about residential status that is associated with crime involvement, victimization, or perpetration. It's more, she had the sense that it had more to do with having co-occurring. And so it was sort of that second look that brought that variable in. But we went to her to say, we need something like if someone's in the home, like how does that affect, you know, their victimization, how their access to, you know, call it into the police. Like it has a huge impact. But and unfortunately, we just weren't able to pull that out.
And the other piece that was intriguing, I think, you know, maybe conversation. So you divided, you categorize people based on services.
Mm-hmm.
So what about people who had intellectual, you know, ID services as well as services? And how did you?
So none of the consumers in the IED population had a co-occurring, had no substance abuse, directly substance abuse services during 2009.
That's unfortunate.
So just a quick comment or question. I don't want to make too much of this, but words do have meaning, and protective could, to some people, have the connotation of an advantage. I mean, yes, they are eligible for health services at greater rates because they tend to have more medical problems aside from the functional definition. So think about it a little bit, okay? Just to again, not a big deal. My question for you, though, is on your graphs, uninsured rates went down a year before the exchanges opened. Any speculation on why that happened?
Yes. So I believe that the prohibition on people with a pre-existing condition was implemented before the exchanges occurred, and we suspect that a lot of these folks were affected by that. So I think that in part is why. We don't know that for sure, but that would be my hypothesis.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And this will be the last question.
I just thought of this. I had a study in Michigan, and just thinking about what we're going through in our state, Montana. I mean, basically, our large institutions are populated by individuals for whom the system has failed, because we do have these siloed programs, and they really do have two different, at least two different. They do need a comprehensive wrap around system. And we're finally closing our institution in Montana, which is great, but we are not, you know, ready necessarily to provide what they need in the community. So I will bring your study back, and I hope we can continue to learn from your work really well.
Thank you so much, and I feel like we're really learning in our community, and it was really it's exciting from a research standpoint, but sort of like the power of the data that led to this partnership with the YWCA, which has led to these trainings, and it's really starting to steamroll. So we're very excited to be part of that and very happy to share our experiences as well.
Well, thank you all so much for your participation. We are at time, but I feel like that's a really great note to end on, that we continue to build on all of your collective lessons learned and data that you've so kindly shared with all of us, and take it back home and be constructive with it and really take that as a call to action for how we can blend this in with the work that we're doing. So let's thank and acknowledge the panel with another round of applause. Thank you.